Well, chapter 11. Now, remember, chapters 10, 11, and 12 are all part of the same vision of the future, of course, that Daniel is given. Notice by the angel. Remember in chapter 10, going back. It was during the third year of the reign of Cyrus. Chapter 10, verse 1. Isn't it interesting how the Bible gives us historical time periods and kings and all. And as we have, the archaeologists have discovered many of the Old Testament, historical writings. I mean, we were in London last year and on a missionary trip. We went into the museum and we found all these Assyrian historical relics and writings and all kinds of awesome stuff going back to the time of Assyria. Assyria, as you recall, was even before the Babylonian kingdom. And so as we look at the history, the natural or secular history, we see it lines up with the Bible. And that's the proper way. I mean, when an archaeologist finds something, it doesn't confirm the Bible. It just confirms what they found. Let's get it straight here. People have it turned around. Oh, the archaeologist found some stuff. It proves the Bible. We don't need you to prove the Bible. The Bible's already proven itself. It's God's the author. But if you found something that lines up with the Bible, then you can be sure that you got something that's authentic. Well, here's the third year of Cyrus. Now, we know that this was 535 B.C. Now, the reason why I'm pointing this out to you, because last three chapters, particularly chapter 11, deals a lot with a particular time period. It's all future for Daniel, though. Now, to us, a lot of it, of course, has already taken place. And so he deals from around this time, 535 B.C., right up until the time period right between the Old and New Testament. It's about a 400-year time period there. They call it the silent years. He goes right up to just about 170 B.C. So the prophecy, so you understand, that's about the time period we're dealing with. And it has to do with Israel. It's not just a matter of a given historical data or prophecy, but it has to do with Israel. It always has to do with Israel. Remember, God has a covenant with Israel. Remember with Abraham? And we need to remember that. And he has a covenant with us, the new covenant. This Sunday we're going to be having communion, and we're reminded of the new covenant, not the old covenant. With Israel, the new covenant, which is in his blood. So, here in chapter 10, we're told that he gets a message from the angel. And he was told here in verse 12 of chapter 10, "Then he said to me, the angel, 'Don't be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come because of your words or your prayer.'" So it took 21 days for the angel to come to reveal to him what he was going to answer his prayer. And he points out the spiritual warfare that's going on. A lot of people don't believe in spiritual warfare. Even some Christians don't believe in the supernatural. I don't understand how you can be a Christian not believing in the supernatural. But we got all kinds of different kinds of Christians, right? So you just kind of have to work with them. But here it is. "The prince," verse 13, "of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, and behold, Michael, one of the chief princes," now he is an angel, as we know, and he is of authority. He's called one of the chief princes. "He came to help me." And this is spiritual warfare. And we read about it in Ephesians. We get more information there about principalities and powers in high places and wickedness in high places. And so the warfare, the kingdom of God against the kingdom of Satan, the kingdom of light against the kingdom of darkness. We're told that the natural man can't understand the things of the Spirit because the God of this age has blinded his eyes. He can't see. Another reason why we need to be effective to the non-believer and bringing the gospel to him is that we would fight the battle spiritually. So we'd be in prayer and that we would ask the Lord. Like that's why the Lord told us to go out in twos. I mean, it's not required, but I think the wisdom there is while one is sharing, the other one's praying. Lord, open up their minds, open their hearts, knock down the walls of pride, give them understanding, give them a teachable heart. You know, the Jehovah Witnesses, they don't do that. They don't know that that's what they're supposed to do. But you and I, when we run into them, we can go to battle, spiritual battle. My wife and I ran into a couple the other day at the park. And we were walking, and they were sharing with people. And so we'd go right up to them when they would be talking to them and say, look, we want to share with you. We're born-again Christians, and this is a cult. And what they're sharing with you is not biblical. And we got into spiritual warfare, almost became physical. And of course, I had put my wife between us, you know, because of fear of injuries. But it can happen. But really, no, the lady came after me, and she was Spanish, so I didn't think she understood a lot of English. She just knew liar, and that's what she kept calling me as she was swinging to me. But hey, spiritual warfare. I'm not going to stand by and watch a cult person tell somebody a lie right in front of me. When they come in my neighborhood, I'll go out after them. I'll say, get out of here. This is my neighborhood. I'm evangelizing this area. You got to get out of here. Don't come and tell Joe across the street. I've been sharing with him for years. Besides, he's already heard you, you know. I think we need to take authority sometimes instead of hiding behind the couch. Honey, tell him there's no one home. So we recognize this. Now, get to chapter 11. This is a continuation. And we recognize of this vision, we recognize the spiritual warfare of just before we get to chapter 11, look at verse 20 of chapter 10. He said to me, the angel, don't you know why I've come to you? To Daniel. He said, you know why I've come to you, Daniel? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. That these are spiritual leaders and authority in behind the kings of various countries. And of course, this leads right into today as well. You know, behind the warfare that's going on. We know that there's spiritual wickedness. But the angel says, I came for this reason, to give you understanding. And so the first 34, there's 45 verses, a long chapter, chapter 11, but the first 34 verses are already fulfilled. From 35 on, 36 on, right there is the future. Now we're going to go back, and we'll cover that in a minute, but just so you see the distinction made there. So, the angel is talking to Daniel. These prophecies are so accurate that skeptics have said that Daniel couldn't have written it. It must have been written much later. Someone else wrote it. The problem is Daniel's name's on it. So they've come up with ideas. Well, he must have written it around 170 B.C. Well, because the history is so accurate, it's to the very, the very person, the place, the timing. But we have a Daniel in the Septuagint, which was written 250 B.C., which was the Hebrew translated into the Greek, the Old Testament. The New Testament wasn't written yet. You know, that wasn't until first century A.D. So we're talking 250 B.C., and the Septuagint was the Hebrew translated into the Greek. And Daniel's name is on it. So we know it goes back 250 B.C. plus. So they're right. No man could have known these things. God is writing these things in advance, and he's given the revelation to Daniel. But you have those people that just don't understand the power of God, as Jesus said to the Pharisees and the scribes, primarily to the scribes. I'm sorry, to the Sadducees who didn't believe in the supernatural. They came up with that hypothetical situation about the man having seven wives. Remember, then whose wife is he going to be in the kingdom? The seven men that died. And pointing out there would be confusion in heaven, in the kingdom. And he says, well, you do err not knowing the power of God nor the scriptures. And that's the problem with the natural man. His view of God is too small. God knows the thing from advance. As a matter of fact, turn with me real quick. quickly over to Isaiah chapter 46. We've got a scripture that illustrates this point. Isaiah 46. Pick it up around verse 8. He says, "Remember this and show yourselves men. Recall to mind, O you transgressors, remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me." By the way, I share this with Jehovah's Witnesses, say that Jesus is a God, a little God, small g. You just can't do that. Not with the Bible. There's no other God. God says, "I don't know of any God beside. There's no God beside me. No Savior. I am God, the Savior." But notice verse 10, declaring the end from the beginning. Notice this. This is what prophecy is all about. He is God. Only God can do this. Declaring the end from the beginning and from the ancient times, things that are not yet done. Saying, "My counsel shall stand and I will do all my pleasure." And so he declares the end from the beginning and from the ancient of times of things that are not yet done. And that's what we see in prophecy. By the way, Bible prophecy is a good tool in sharing with non-believers, because so much of the Bible is prophecy. And so we need to use Bible prophecy. Many times I think it's helpful and effective in sharing with non-believers. So back to Daniel chapter 11. So God writes in advance, naming the events, the people, places, the conditions, the history in advance, proof that God is speaking to us. Fulfilled prophecy. And really there's no other answer except God is the author of the Bible. And we get more prophecy here in chapter 11. And you read these prophecies and then you compare it with the secular history, and they're just so accurate. And you can look the secular history up, and you can see that these things did take place. So the angel speaking to Daniel here in chapter 11, the continuation of chapter 10, and going into chapter 12, he says, "Also in the first year of Darius the Mede." Now remember the vision that Daniel got of the four world kingdoms of man. The Babylonian, now replaced by the Medo-Persian. That's the kingdom that Daniel is writing this prophecy during this time. Medo-Persian. Belshazzar now has been replaced, the last king of Babylon. And Cyrus and Darius now, the Medes and the Persians, a huge, powerful empire ruling now. And so it was the first year of Darius, so we know the time period. I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. I believe the angel is speaking here, strengthening Darius, because God sets up kings and takes them down. That's why I don't worry that much about politics. You find, you know, the secular people get so worried and work so hard about, you know, trying to get this politician in and that one. And, you know, I think we should vote. I mean, I know we should vote. And we should vote responsibly and according to our Christian principles, not according to our economics. But I believe that God does everything in order. If we get a Democrat in power, hey, that's just much sooner the Lord will come back. That's the way I see it, you know. Now, if you're a Democrat and you take offense to that, it's okay. You know, stick around. You know, you'll get offended later on. So, and you can offend me if you like, because it's all right. I'm worse than that, whatever you think of me. Remember Sunday, I told you I never claimed to be a nice guy. There's not going to be any nice people in heaven, just saved sinners. So, besides, nice people are kind of boring sometimes, don't you think? They're just so nice, you want to almost do something to see how deep that niceness goes. Trip them, or, you know, I've always done that. I like nice people, but I like to have fun with them, you know. There's this attitude, though, isn't it, that it's all about being nice. Now some of you are thinking, "Oh, Pastor, what about the fruit of the Spirit? Love and joy and patience." And, well, you can still exercise that. fruit in your life. You should have that in your life. But at the same time, don't take yourself so seriously that you begin to believe that you are something when you're not. Amen? Yeah. So, and now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia. Medo-Persian Empire. So there's going to be four kings altogether. And there's going to be three more that are going to arise. This is what the angel is telling Daniel in the future. And the fourth shall be far richer, than them all. So the last king of Persia, Medo-Persian Empire, he's going to be the most powerful. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. You know, it's kind of interesting that things haven't changed. You know, the most powerful countries are the richest countries. You know, the only way we really were able to defeat Russia was not militarily. We just had more money. We spent so much money on arms they couldn't keep up. And they said, all right, we quit. That's pretty much what happened. It was kind of a bummer for 007 and those guys, but it's over now, you know. Probably the timing was good. I think it's over for them too, isn't it? Have you seen them? Never mind. But anyway, and it was the same then. They amassed these treasures and of course they built war machines, chariots, and I mean in some cases even the Medo-Persians. They would get elephants in these battles, and I mean you bought your army is what you basically did, and so he's going to be the richest, and so three more kings, Persian kings after. Now who's the king now? Cyrus. We just were told he's the king, and this came to pass. There were four more kings. Xerxes put an army together. He was a Medo-Persian, the last. And he marched against Greece, and he was defeated. This was in 480 B.C. The amazing thing about the Persians, they were really known for being able to amass huge armies, over or as much as a million men. Can you imagine? I mean, they just had this brute strength. They weren't like the Romans. The Romans were more disciplined. They had large armies, but their strength wasn't in their number. It was more in their military expertise. But the Medo-Persians were different. They just would come in with a million men. Just, you know, you just didn't have enough spears or arrows for them. You know, they would fire their arrows, and they would even warn their enemies. We have so many archers. When we fire our arrows, it blacks out, darkens out the sun. That's how they conquered. That's how they conquered their enemies. And so Daniel, he tells us about it here. This is 300 years in advance before this last king, a Medo-Persian king. And we read here, a mighty king, verse 3, shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And, of course, now we know from the prophecies that particularly the prophecy of Nebuchadnezzar, of the four major world empires, the Babylonian, which was replaced in succession by the Medo-Persian, which is going to be replaced by Alexander the Great. Now, this is yet future. Daniel's getting the vision. He's still, there's going to be three more kings after Cyrus. So he's getting these prophecies of the next few hundred years, about 300 years in the future. But then at the end of this chapter, he also gets a vision of the Antichrist. There's a type of the Antichrist here in this time period, but in the future, some 2,000 years to the future, as we're still looking for, well, we're not looking for him, but he's yet future. No, I'm looking for Jesus. There are a lot of people looking for the Antichrist. They'll ask me, who do you think it is? I remember back in Kissinger days, do you think it's Kissinger? And I'd say, yeah, just to mess with him. I never thought it was. Were you lying? No, just kidding. But anyway, I don't lie. I'm a Christian. I just exaggerate a little bit. But anyway, in the name of Jesus, see if you can exaggerate. And whatever you do, just put the name of Jesus, right? And we get away. You can even hit somebody. in the name of Jesus. It's okay. Then it's righteous anger or something. I don't know. Okay, I'm just kidding. Now look, you're going to go and get in a fight. Say, the pastor said it, we can hit as long as you say, in the name of Jesus. But we read now about this mighty king here in verse 3. Who is Alexander the Great? He's going to lead the Greeks to replace the Medo-Persians. But we're told first there's going to be four of them. Four Medo-Persian kings. But this mighty king, as we know, Alexander the Great, verse 3, verse 4, and when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided towards the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity. See, he had no children. So his kingdom, when he conquered the known world, he conquered from India all the way over into Egypt, the known world, conquered the Medo-Persian Empire, all the way down to India. As a matter of fact, when there were no more kingdoms to conquer, they said he fell before his generals started weeping because there was no more kingdoms to defeat. He says, but not according to his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for the others besides these. Now this prophecy was fulfilled with Alexander the Great, and then of course this one was fulfilled with his kingdom was divided up into the four generals. And of course the kingdom was not very strong after that. If you've done any reading in history about Alexander the Great, he's a pretty interesting guy. He was 32 years old when he died. He died drunk. And the story is that he was an alcoholic, or I don't believe in that, but he was a drunk. And I don't believe anyone's a victim. He chose to drink, and so he drank, and he came back from a party, and he was drunk and wet from a rainstorm, and he fell in his bed wet, drunk, and he woke up with pneumonia, according to history, and died. There are some others that disagree, and they say he died of malaria and drunkenness. So either story, but either or, he's... That was the case with him. His kingdom was divided into four generals, four sections of the Medo-Persian Empire was divided, and which was most of the known world at that time. This is around 300 BC, 300 years before Christ. So Rome has not yet come on to the scene yet. We know that the Roman Empire is going to replace the Grecian Empire. So keep those empires in mind. And then, of course, the last empire that's yet future is related to the Roman Empire with the ten toes, which speaks of the ten nations is yet future, but related to Rome. Now, where did Rome rule? Where was their kingdom? Europe. So it's going to be ten nations of the European community. So we got our eye on Europe right now. We're really looking for Jesus. We don't need any more prophecy to be fulfilled for the rapture of the church. But in the meantime, if we keep our eyes on current events, we can see the things developing in the world scene. We know we're getting close. That shows us that the rapture is even closer. So Rome at this time period of this prophecy, now we've gone from the Medo-Persian to the Greek. Now we see that Alexander, the Greek ruler, is dead, and his kingdom now has been divided into four generals. Daniel's getting his prophecy. This is over 200 years before Alexander was even born. But Daniel's getting the prophecy from the angel. And so, now, from the descendants of two of these generals, these Greek generals, the kingdom of Syria now comes to be. This wasn't a major empire, though. But it was part of the four generals that had split up from the Grecian Empire. And the Syrian Empire to the north, kings, and it's noted here, is the kings of the north were warring with the kings of the south. The kings of the south is Egypt. Guess who's in the middle? Israel. And so they are squeezed between these armies and these wars that go on for many, many years. And so Israel suffers. So we see that as we continue reading. Now, notice verse 5. Then the king of the south. Again, the king of the south, when you think of south, you think of what's south of Israel? Egypt. So that's correct. Shall become strong, as well as one of the princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion, and his dominion shall be a great dominion. You know, one of the things that I noticed in studying history, and in the United States we study just American history. When you go over to Europe, the Europeans have world history in mind. And sometimes you feel a little foolish when you talk to them because we're not that familiar, unless you've been to college, you're not that familiar with world history. And so, and when we travel to Israel, and the guides are taking us to various locations, they start talking about world history and all these different kingdoms and going all the way back to some of the kingdoms that we're talking about. And it's easy for Americans to get lost because we're not that familiar as a people world history. So one of the things that might be helpful to you in your study of the Bible is also to get familiar with world history as it pertains to Bible prophecy in particular. So the kings of the south shall become strong. That's Egypt, verse 5. As well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion, and his dominion shall be a great dominion. Now verse 6, and at the end of some years they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north and to make an agreement. So we know that Egypt, the king of the south, and the king of the north, Syria, were at war with one another. These two generals had split up of the four generals and had been divided up into these two, and they were at war with one another. But we read here in verse 6 that that they're going to join forces. Now, it's interesting here. In verse 6, it says that, and the daughter of the king of the south, now that's Egypt, shall go to the king of the north, Syria, to make an agreement, but she shall not retain power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand. But she shall be given up, and with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in these or those times. So, interesting prophecy. What we have here in this agreement, as we mentioned, between the Egyptian kings and the Syrian kings, this is around 250 BC. Daniel's getting these prophecies. We know now they've already been fulfilled, but at this time it's many years before him. The king of Egypt gives his daughter, Bernice, to be the wife of the king of Syria to the north. This was not uncommon. You remember, and we read about Solomon and all of his wives. Many of those wives he got was for treaty purposes. If you wanted a treaty with a warring neighbor, you just give him your daughter to marry, and then it's kind of hard to fight with your father-in-law, you know, sort of a family thing. And it actually did, it was somewhat effective. This is what we're reading about here. And so, the only problem, though, that the king of Syria was married. And so what he did is he divorced his wife and he married Bernice, who was given to him by the king of Egypt. Well, what happened? The king of Egypt died. So the king of Syria says, well, I don't want his daughter anymore, so he puts her away. This is what we're reading here. And so he takes back his first wife. This is all according to secular history. It's interesting to know the prophecy here, 200 years before it took place. Well, his first wife was mad at him for putting her away and marrying Bernice, so she poisoned him. I thought it was appropriate. By the way, they had guys that tasted the food and stuff in those days, so that guy got fired, I'm sure. Or no, he lost his head. You know, that's one of those jobs. It's not a good job. So, I mean, you talk about soaps today. I mean, I hope no one here watches the soaps, but this is the same thing. Nothing new under the sun. As a matter of fact, they could read this and probably do a series on something like this, you know. But the wife that had poisoned her husband because he took on this other wife, she has Bernice killed, the Egyptian wife that took her husband, has her killed, and then she has her son put into power. So now he's the king of Syria. Well, Bernice's brother down in Egypt, he's mad about what's going on, so he gathers an army and comes up with his army and defeats the Syrian king and kills Bernice. So, just amazing prophecy. So, by the way, you can find many of these things, these historical truths, in your encyclopedias or other good historical books. It's all there. And here it is in the prophecies of Daniel, fulfilled prophecies. And so Bernice's brother, he comes and he tries to save her, but he's too late. They killed his sister, but he defeats the Syrians. And that's what we have here in verses 6 and 7. And you see here that she shall not retain her power. You know, that's because she was killed. And neither was he able to, because he was killed too. And then verse 7, but from a branch of her roots, now that's her brother, we just discussed that, one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army and enter into the fortress of the king of the north, that's Syria, and deal with them and prevail. As I was studying the Egyptians came up and they attacked them at Antioch, and you know where Antioch is, that's where, in the New Testament, Paul's spent a lot of his time in ministry up there. And it's up by Lebanon today, if you're familiar with that area. So verse 8, and he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and shall continue more years than the king of the north, or of Syria. So Daniel's prophecy. They take about a 15-year rest, they gather up their army, and then they attack them again, and then they might get the victory, and then they take their spoils back. But poor Israel, they're right in the middle. And Israel's been, sometimes they make bad decisions, they'll join up against the Egyptians, and then they'll be destroyed. Or then we find many times the Assyrians will be angry at their defeat in Egypt, and they'll take it out on the Jews. And so study some of the other Old Testament books, we see, you go through the book of Ezra, and you see how this took place. Remember how she was brought in as the queen of the Persian king. So, all this, all fits together. All prophecy being fulfilled. Verse 9, then the king of the north, again, Syria, shall come to the kingdom of the and the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. However, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces. See, again, he waited about 14 years. He gathered up another army. One shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. And so the Assyrians, or I should say Syrians, not the Assyrians. And that's another distinction we need to make sure that we're not confusing the Assyrians with the Syrians. It's a different time period. We're around 250 B.C. now. About 220 actually. So the sons of the Syrian king, one of them, years later, comes to power. And Antiochus is the Syrian king. And he takes this large army from the north and he attacks Egypt. 220 B.C. He goes through Israel, and of course they suffer. And the Syrians this time are defeated. Notice, and the king of the south, verse 11, shall be moved with rage, that's the Egyptians, and go out and fight with him and with the king of the north, the Syrians, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemies. So the Egyptians win this war.
And when he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. And again, now he's persecuting the Jews, the Assyrian king. And when he has taken away the multitude, verse 12, his heart will be lifted up, as we mentioned. Verse 13, the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come into the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. And in those times, many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also certain violent men of your people, that's Israel, shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision that they shall fall. So they joined up many times in these battles against the Syrians and sometimes against the Egyptians. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength. So Antiochus, he is defeated now by the Egyptians, the Assyrian king. He's a pretty famous king, but he is defeated now. And he is the fourth king that Daniel wrote about. And he who comes against him, verse 16, shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land. Now, this is Israel. It's always about Israel. And we need to remember that. That's what this is all about. With the destruction of his power. And then we read in verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter in with the strength of his whole kingdom, upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it. But she shall not stand with him or be with him. So verse 17 is an interesting verse. The king of Egypt, actually the king of Syria, the northern kingdom, he gives his daughter. I always thought she was Egyptian. It's Cleopatra. And actually she wasn't. She was from Syria. She was given to the king of Egypt as a bride. Antiochus' daughter, the Syrian, he's the king. He gives his daughter, Cleopatra, as a treaty to the king of Egypt. And we read that she turns against her dad, though, the Assyrian king, and Antiochus, and turns against her own nation, Syria, and stands with her new husband, the king of Egypt. And many of you have seen the movie Cleopatra, and so you know that this is accurate. Come on, that's Hollywood's version, you know. It's kind of funny, you talk to young people today, and you talk to them about, did you ever read, or you remember studying, and they said, was there a video out on it? So you're going to have to work with that. So, now the Romans haven't come to power yet. So we're just getting close now to that in this prophecy. So verse 18, after this he shall turn his face to the coastland. He's talking about Antiochus, the Assyrian king. And he shall take many. He goes to the coastland. Now, he turns his armies towards the Greek islands. So he's been fighting the Egyptians. Now he goes towards the Mediterranean, up towards Greece. This is many years after Alexander. The Grecian Empire has already been defeated, as you know, if you get your timetable right here. The Medo-Persians have been defeated. Alexander the Great has come to power. He dies. He's only 32. His kingdom split up into four generals. Two of them have been dissolved. We have two major ones now from that empire, which is the kings of the north, Syrian, the kings of the south, Egypt. And they keep fighting together against each other. Israel's in the middle. So we're winding down. We're about 175 B.C. now. He's getting these prophecies. Rome has not really entered in yet into the prophecy. Then he shall turn his face, as we mentioned, towards the Greek islands. But a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end, and with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. So what happens is he's taking all these treasures that he has accumulated, and he has to now pay the Romans, because the Romans have come in with their navy. Rome had a pretty good navy, and the Assyrians didn't, and they were defeated there at Alexandria down in Egypt by the Romans. And so the Syrian king is upset now because he has to pay taxes to the Romans. One thing about the Romans, they were very powerful, wealthy, because they collected taxes from all those that they conquered. That's where the Americans got the idea. The Romans were good at it, but nothing like Americans. We tax, of course, Europe's pretty bad, too. But the Romans didn't. Now, if you remember, Matthew was a tax collector, remember? And you remember how they hated him because he would take taxes from the Jews to give to Rome. And then he got his percent. And so you know how that incentive works. You know, you got to give Rome the first 80% or 85%, then you get the last 15%. But it's hard to get that collect that last 15%. When I was a paper boy, I had that problem. I still remember it. I'd build up my paper route. I remember I had 120 accounts one time. I mean, I'd get up early and fold them papers, put them rubber bands around them, and put them in my bags and throw them over my bike and just take off. And I'll tell you, I earned my money because where I grew up, we had a lot of, we didn't have leash laws in those days. And so dogs ran loose, and they were all mean dogs. Nobody had foo-foo dogs. There were no Newport Beach dogs. You know, foo-foo dogs wouldn't last 2 days in my town. All the dogs were mean, and they were all mixed, big, mean dogs, missing teeth and dried blood on them. They were mean dogs. And they knew me. They knew I'd be coming. And I would go in certain areas, and I'd get going. And I had a weapon with me. It was sort of like a rubber bat. And I'd whack these dogs, and they'd chase me, you know. Oh, they were trying to take my leg off. These weren't little nippers. These dogs took chunks of flesh and clothing. But, you know, I had to make a living. You know, I didn't come from an Orange County home. I had no money. My parents said, "You want any money? Go work. Get it." So, you know, at nine, I was selling papers. And the hardest part was collecting. It was the Daily Tribune. I'd give them their first 85%, and I got to collect from the deadbeats. You know, the guys that didn't want to pay. And I was persistent. I would go and wake them up on Saturday morning, because they'd never be there during the week, right? So I'd go there at 6 o'clock in the morning. You know how little kids are. They're right awake at 6 o'clock, ready to go. Cheerios, and, you know, a lot of sugar, about 2 cups of sugar on it. On my bike. And, you know, some of these guys, they wake up, they've been partying all night, man. And I'll never forget this one guy comes to the door, you know, he's just to hold it open. And I'm just a dumb little kid, collecting for the Daily Tribune. And I'll never forget, he just went, bam, and he kicked my collection book, and all my receipts went flying in the wind. And I ran out there, and the dogs came out, and they're biting me, and I was trying to get my receipts. Try to explain this stuff to my kids because they don't understand it. They just come up, "Hey, Dad, you got 20 bucks? You know, I go, $20? I worked for 6 months for $20. And, well, that might be an exaggeration. So that story had something to do with the teaching in the Bible, and I think it had to do with taxes. That's what it was. So, those were fun times. I remember if you got enough starch, you could go to the Pike. You guys probably don't remember the Pike, but it was in Long Beach. It was the weirdest place in the country. I thought the rides were cool. They were, but it was nothing compared to the people. The people that hung out at the Pike were awesome. I mean, they were like, not popular tattoos like you have today. These guys were serious about their tattoos. And they just covered their scars. I mean, these people were something else. And I'd get on the roller coaster. I remember coming in the bus. I think I was about 9 or 10. And looking at that roller coaster. We didn't have, Disneyland didn't have anything. You know, the fastest thing they had over there was the bumper cars, you know. It was kind of Mickey Mouse, but get it? But the Pike was awesome. You get on that roller coaster, and, I mean, your heart just, especially when you're 9 years old, you know. And I still remember how scary the roller coaster was, but I don't know what was scarier. The guy pulling the thing going, you guys ready, you know? Those carny guys, you know? You know, his eyes are like... I thought, I'm going to die, you know. And so me and my two friends, we're trying to get down in there low, because you get it, the thing, yeah, roller coaster, you've never been on one, you're 9 years old, and it just takes its time. And you look around the ocean, and all of a sudden, your friend starts telling you the story. You know, four sailors have been killed on this roller coaster. How many? Yeah, this thing's gone out into the ocean a couple of times. They put too much grease on it. Woo! Woo-hoo-hoo! You know. And you hit that top, and you look around, this is great, and whoa, down it goes, man. And you're just, you know, trying to get underneath, you know. I thought I was all brave until that day. And then when I go, hey, I was just kidding, man. Let's do it again. Not right now, you know. So, Matthew was a tax collector, and he got to keep the extra bit. So he's defeated now by the Romans. He's angry about not being able to defeat the Egyptians because now the Romans have come in and they're gaining power. So this king of the north, verse 19, he shall turn his face towards the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. And so he is, Antigonus is killed, but his son now, takes over, and there shall rise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. And in his place shall arise a vile person, a wicked person, an evil man, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceable, and seize the kingdom by intrigue or flattery. Here is the type of the Antichrist in the Old Testament here, in verse 20-22. This Antiochus Epiphanes is well known as the evil, vile person who caused so much evil to Israel that, well, let's read on and we'll read more about him. Verse 23, and after notice in verse 22, with the force of a flood they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. This was the high priest. He had made a covenant with him, and he killed him and spread his blood all over the Holy of Holies and on the walls of the sanctuary. You see, he's a type of the Antichrist. And he is what we read, a vile, wicked person with the force of a flood. In verse 23, and after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people, and he shall enter in, notice, peaceably, just like the Antichrist, as we read about in the book of Revelation. Remember how he enters in with flattery. He deceives the world. Remember that no one could speak as he could. No one had the wisdom. Remember, Satan gives the Antichrist all of his power, that same power he offered Jesus, and he said, Jesus, I know why you came. I'm prepared to give you the kingdoms of the world if you'll bow down and worship me. And Jesus spoke of the Antichrist. He said, I have come in my Father's name, and you've rejected me. Another will come, and him you'll receive. This is not him. This is a type of the Antichrist in the Old Testament. And he shall enter in peaceably, verse 24, even in the richest places, and the province, and he shall do whatever his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers, and he shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. So he spreads all the bounty he has. He starts giving it away to Israel, and he wins their favor. Notice it's by deceit. He makes a treaty with the high priest, and he's just setting everybody up. And he ends up killing somewhere between 40 and 80,000 Israelites, Jews. He steals all the treasure from the temple. And he stirs up, verse 25, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south, which is Egypt, and with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. And that's when Rome comes in and helps Egypt against the king of Syria. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. So it's like today. You know, I think of in World War II when Hitler would get together with England and the Allies, and they discuss how they're going to divide up Europe. And you remember, I believe it was Prime Minister Chamberlain who made treaty with Hitler. And Hitler never kept the treaty, and he promised he wouldn't attack Poland or France if they gave him Czechoslovakia. So they sacrificed Czechoslovakia. And you remember Hitler's words, "Our enemies are worms." You see, you can never give in to bullies, either on a local level or on a national level. It's just wrong to do. And the same thing was going on here. You know, as they talk about how they meet at their tables and they discuss treaties and all, but they can't be trusted. Yes, those who eat, verse 26, the portion of the delicacies shall destroy him, and his army shall be swept away. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. Now, you watch the politicians today, and it's interesting how one of the advantages of video, though, they can catch them in their lies. So verse 20, while returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. So on his way back from Egypt, he's angry, and so he takes it out on Israel again. And at the appointed time, he shall return and go towards the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. And so he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary and the fortress. And then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place the abomination that causes desolation. Now, you don't want to confuse this with what Jesus said to the disciples when he said the abomination that causes desolation. When you see that spoken of by Daniel, flee. He's talking about the Antichrist. This is a type in the Old Testament. Obviously, it has to be future, or Jesus wouldn't have been speaking about it. This happened way 200 years before Jesus, or 175 years before Jesus was born. So, you notice he comes in and he's angry. He hates the Jews, the Assyrian king. And he takes away their daily sacrifices. And he places there an abomination. He actually takes a pig, and he slays the pig, and he offers the blood on the Holy of Holies on the altar. And he's just, as we read, he's the vile man. And as I mentioned earlier, he kills the high priest. He sets up an image of Jupiter in the Holy Holies. And he just just destroys the Jews. Some writer said as many as 100,000 were killed. Finally, the Jews are so angry at this, even though they're overwhelmed in terms of numbers, they begin to fight back under the leadership of Judas Maccabees and his sons. And they end up defeating the Assyrian forces, and they regain the city and the temple. They cleanse it, and they have, as you're familiar with, the Feast of Dedication. Actually, Jesus talked about it when he was in the temple area during the, it was winter during the Feast of Dedication. Now, that's where the Jews get Hanukkah. And you notice it's right around Christmas, the winter time. And so you find this in history. You can get it in the Apocrypha. Of course, we don't have the Apocrypha in our Bibles. The Catholic Bible does have them. We don't believe that we believe they're good historical books, but that's all. But you can also get it 1st, 2nd Maccabees in the Apocrypha. You can also pick up this information, historical information from Josephus. We have the books in the bookstore if you're interested. So they fight against the Assyrian king. And you know what's interesting? They're still fighting to this day. Now, there's been a 2,000-year dispersion. 70 A.D., they were, of course, destroyed by the Roman Caesar, and 1 million Jews were killed. This is 170 years, almost 200 years later, during the time of Jesus, after they crucified him. They're sent into slavery. They're all over the world. The Lord said, I'm going to bring them back. Now, we're in that time period now. So Daniel's getting all of this prophecy. We got the Old Testament type of the Antichrist. And we have many types in the Old Testament going to be fulfilled in the New Testament. And we remember that in the New Testament, we just finished in the book of Revelation, when he again brings his nation back, the Jews back to their land again, and during the Great Tribulation, which is yet future, we just read about it in Daniel 9, that last seven-year period. We read that the Antichrist is going to enter into the scene. We actually get him here. And verse 32, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. This is still the Syrian king, Antiochus. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out the great exploits. So there are Jews, as we mentioned, the Maccabees, that won't yield. And they fight against him and they prevail. And those are the people who understand shall instruct many, verse 33, for many days, and they shall fall by the sword and flame and captivity and plunder. So they lost many, as we mentioned, to the Syrians. Now when they fell, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue, or flattery. Many of them went against the Maccabees. Same thing is going to happen in the future. The Antichrist comes on the scene. Most of Israel is going to be deceived by the Antichrist because they're going to get their temple back and they're going to again have their sacrifices again. They haven't had their sacrifices since the time of Jesus. And so, as you know, today many the Orthodox Jews, they want their temple. They want to have their sacrifices again. They got their nation, but they don't have their temple. Now, we read in the book of Revelation that the angel told John to measure the temple and to leave out that area of the Gentiles. It's given over to the Gentiles. We believe that's the mosque that's on the Temple Mount now. There's still room up there to build the temple. There may be a wall put between them. It really doesn't matter to us. It's just interesting. But in our last trip to Israel, we went into the Temple Institute, and there's these Jews that are committed to the temple rebuilding, and they've got all the instruments that are for the temple going back to the time of Solomon's temple. All of the furniture, all of the trumpets, all of the furniture that's necessary, they got it. They're all ready. They're prepared. Now all they need is the temple to be rebuilt. We know that the Antichrist makes a covenant with Israel for 7 years. They get their temple back. They get their sacrifices back. But it says in the midst or in the middle of that week, 7 years, 3.5 years, right in the middle, he goes into the Holy of Holies, into the temple, and makes an image of himself. Now the Old Testament Syrian king makes an image, but not of himself. And we read about it here in verse 35, and some of those who understand shall fall. Verse 35, until the time of the end, because it's still for the appointed time or the end. Now verse 36 starts the future. Up until this point, this is all future, of course, for Daniel, but it's all been fulfilled for us. Already taken place. Verse 36 is now great tribulation period. Notice verse 36. Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify, notice, himself above every god, and shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods. So against God Jehovah. This is what Jesus is talking about to the Jews when you see the abomination. This right here that caused desolation, flee into the wilderness. And we know that God's prepared a place for them in Jordan, Petra. Matter of fact, Christians go there now and they're putting canned foods and other foods there for them when they come. And he shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. Now this is great tribulation. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers. Now a lot of people think this means he's going to be a Jew, the Antichrist. I don't know. It's interesting though. It says he shall, verse 30, shall not regard the God of his father nor the desire of women. Now some say he's going to be homosexual. The way things are going today, it's real possible. I don't know. There it is. Nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above them all. Isn't that interesting? Oh, we've ran over it. As soon as you read this, so who are you thinking of? You can't help from thinking of Satan. Lucifer, how he said, I would magnify myself above the God of heaven. If you're taking notes, it's Isaiah 14. But in their place, verse 38, he shall honor a God of fortresses, and a God which his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and blessed things. But we know the Antichrist will make an image of himself. And so, verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horses, and men. And we believe this is all great tribulation period. Daniel's got a vision, it's hard to describe modern warfare. The Antichrist shall also enter into the glorious land. Notice that, verse 41. Israel. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand. Edom, Moab, which is Jordan. He shall stretch out his hand, verse 42, against the countries and the land of Egypt, and shall not escape. And he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also, Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. Now, this is interesting, verse 44. It says, the news from the east and the north shall trouble him. So, we're reading about the Antichrist now. He is down in, as we've been reading, in Ethiopia, Egypt. He's conquering, fighting down there. And he hears news of the armies from the east coming. Look at verse 44. News from the east and from the north shall trouble him. From the north would be Russia. So it appears from our studies of the book of Revelation and from other studies here, particularly Old Testament, that he hears now, he's down in Africa, he's fighting there in Ethiopia and Egypt. He hears about this 200 million man army that we read about in the book of Revelation coming from the east, coming towards him. And he turns his army around and he starts going towards the north now, and they meet there in Megiddo for the Battle of Armageddon. And I'll tell you, we've been there. It is an awesome place. You stand up in Megiddo, their mountain or hills, and you look down in this huge, huge valley as far as you can see. And we know that that's where the last battle will be fought. And we read in verse 44, "And therefore he shall go out with a great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him." And so